It's really just about that perception that we have about money. And it goes back to some of the things that happened to us when we were kids. Is it the root of all evil? Are you 50 years old and still actually walking around at a subconscious level believing that money is the root of all evil and that rich people are greedy? And because I bet you that the people who have that knee-jerk reaction to, oh, I don't want any money, and they shun money, it's because they have a certain relationship with it that isn't necessarily positive.
I'm Dan Smolin, and this is the Dan Smolin Podcast. We help people to navigate the future of work, to work that is profound, protects the planet, empowers people and communities, and is fun to do, meaningful work. The stories that our guests tell and the insights that they provide will inspire you to connect with work and experiences that stoke your passions and make the world a better place. For the future of work is meaningful work. This summer, we focus on the mission of the Dan Smolin Experience to help people find success and enjoyment in the work that they do and hope to do. We believe there are four career journey components that get people to blissful work and career experiences, and they are dream, explore, strategize, and act. First, we encourage people of all ages, backgrounds, and levels of education and training to dream about the kind of work that they believe will make them happy and well-purposed. Next, we guide them to explore opportunities to do the work that they dream about. Then, we focus them to strategize, to align with the skill and experience needed to do the work and opportunities of their choosing. And last, we prod them to act, to seize on the opportunities to do the work of their dreams. We believe that the key to success is intentionality, allowing dreams, explorations, strategies, and actions to happen fluidly. To be truly successful in the future of work, we must be career intentional about dreaming, exploring, strategizing, and acting throughout our lives. You can find useful and actionable podcast episodes and blog posts on dansmolin.com. Use the spyglass to search for content to dream, explore, strategize, and act. And when on the site, make sure you sign up for our free newsletter. Just click the newsletter tab on the top of our webpage, then click subscribe, and you will be on your way. In a dynamic future of work, agility is key, and our ever-changing dreams can help us align with future success. Mother Earth is on fire, and the effects of climate change and the COVID-19 pandemic change the work that we do and hope to do. Crisis is now factored in to the future of work. My tour guide on a 2019 trip to the Netherlands described the mission of his profession succinctly. Dan, he said, I work to keep issues from becoming problems, and I solve problems so that they do not become crises. Practically every workforce professional addresses issues on a daily basis. These can be time and place management constraints. But often, these issues are the line items provided in the specs for the jobs that they were hired to do. For instance, a marketing manager is tasked with overcoming the issue of consumer loyalty erosion. And likewise, an architect looks for ways to mitigate the issue of inefficient energy usage. And successful people ably keep their work issues in check. They end each day's work knowing that the issues that they addressed were solved or at least well contained. But in the first 7 months of 2021, the work that we do became existential. With forest fires and extreme water scarcity ravaging much of the western United States, and Delta variant COVID outbreaks spiking throughout the country, problems and crises reached both our job specs and our workplaces. So, are we ready to handle full-blown crisis on the job? The crises that we address originated beyond the job spec. In fact, they extend to how work enmeshes into our daily lives. While some workplaces allow people the option to continue remote work or to pivot to hybrid work, others demand that their talent return now to the traditional office. The workforce endures the impacts of the Great Resignation, and disproportionately, in 2020 and 2021, women dropped out of the American workforce, often because they couldn't return to a co-located workplace while managing childcare and the needs of other family members. Among those who resigned are people who fear that a return to the traditional setting will subject them again to workplace toxicity and incivility. Perhaps the biggest crisis many face on the job originates with hiring managers who seek to restore workplace life to their pre-pandemic conditions. But we must strive for a truly intentional workplace. Hiring managers need to be cognizant of the issues and problems that their talent endure to do the job so that things don't turn critical like an out-of-control forest fire. The story of crisis and the future of work is also told through a personal financial lens. Oftentimes, the way we handle the building of wealth affects our opportunities to do the future work of our choosing. People who budget well and intentionally build their financial wealth have more future work choices to consider than those who don't put in the time to manage their financial resources. And to that end, people who ignore their finances turn money issues into full-blown money crises. Absent well-tended financial resources, they are left to do the work that may keep them afloat, but offers them no positive meaning. And with money in mind, we are happy to revisit our conversation with financial expert Angela Anderson. Angela is a veteran wealth advisor who counsels entrepreneurs and other careerists to make sound money decisions. With a process of thorough engagement that includes money therapy and other tools, Angela frees people to build wealth, and that allows them more choices to enjoy a good retirement or perhaps a second or third act career that favors positive meaning and social purpose. Our conversation with Angela Anderson was recorded during April 2021. Do give it a listen. So let's get started. Tell us about your company, Mattel. What is it and the value that you provide your clients?
So Mattel is actually a combination of my son's names, Matthias and Talis. So we just brought the two together and came up with Mattel. And we actually do a few things in my company. The main thing is financial counseling and money therapy and wealth strategy. And so I work with entrepreneurs that are earning six figures, multiple six figures. So you're starting to turn over profits. Congratulations. And now it's time to make decisions about what to do with your money so you can keep more of it, you can grow it. And all of those choices and those options start opening up to you when you become profitable. So that's the main focus, and that's what we do is we offer counseling services, support services, and then that will also help you leverage and really optimize your relationship with other financial professionals in your life, like a CPA or a financial advisor.
So you specialize in helping entrepreneurs to get them on the road to financial security, I suppose. When we spoke in pre-interview, you used an interesting sports metaphor to describe your role as it contrasts to the role of a traditional financial advisor. And you said to me that you get your clients off of the bench and onto the field. whereas a financial advisor gets them into the game. So what do you focus your skill on in getting people off the bench and onto the field?
So there's a couple of things that happen when you own your own business. Whether you've worked for a company before or not, most people that go to work have a retirement plan that when you fill out your paperwork, your first day, you're in HR, you're ticking the boxes and contributing to retirement, and oftentimes your company is even matching you. And it's one of those things that happens pretty passively. Like most people, that's just a given. Another given when you go to work is your insurances. And so when you own your own company, though, and you go into business for yourself, these are some of the last things that we forget to do as entrepreneurs, is that now we need to figure out our own health insurance. Now we need to figure out our own retirement options and put that into place. And I will tell everybody that I believe you know you need to do this. And everyone talks about, yeah, I need to diversify my income. I need to create other income streams. I need to start investing. I need to do this. We all know, but we don't do it. And there's a million reasons why we don't do it. A lot of it is because we don't know the right people. We don't have the education in order to understand what is it that we actually need to do and how we need to do it, and then how to connect with the right people. And so that's what I mean by you've got a business, and so you're on the field, you're in the arena, because money is circulating in your life, you're generating it, you're spending it, you're doing all the things, but you're not on the playing field with everyone else who is doing these different things with money that is part of creating financial security for you and your business. And entrepreneurs, in my opinion, are very underserved in terms of the financial world because we don't show up to work and tick the boxes and have everything done for us. We have to do it, or we have to know people who can do it for us. So that's where I come in and say, I take you by the hand and we look through all your stuff, get it organized, get you on a plan that's in alignment with who you are, where you want to go, how you want to do things with your money, the purpose behind it, and then connect you with what you need to do and who you need to do it with in order for your income to grow and for that wealth to have that wealth foundation in your life.
I do recognize what was missing in my pivot to becoming an entrepreneur, and that was the safety net my hiring company provided me in terms of health benefits and insurance and days off. But I'm curious, what are your clients most obsessed with in terms of either mastering or getting accustomed to their path to financial security?
What I've seen a lot, Dan, is that my clients, they're actually the first people in their family that stand a chance to become truly wealthy, meaning that maybe they came from a family where people went to college or graduated college, but maybe not. But most people's parents were not entrepreneurs, and they're the first entrepreneurs in their family. And not only the first entrepreneurs, but they're actually doing really well. And so there's this ocean, though, of, okay, I created my own job, I'm doing really well, but I can't necessarily talk with my family about money because they did the traditional path. And furthermore, Angela, they didn't sit around and talk about how their portfolios are growing, or how they're going to take their money and invest it in real estate and do all these different things. It wasn't a dinner conversation subject for most people. So that's what I find, is that there is an ocean of new thoughts and new emotions and new feelings that come up for these entrepreneurs that are doing really well. They don't have family to turn to. They don't have a family wealth manager. They just don't know where to go. And so what they find themselves doing is just piling all the money in their savings account. Mm-hmm. and hoping their accountant will know more and get them set up on the right path with some things. And so it's not like they're going out and buying Louis Vuitton with every $10,000 that they earn. They know that, hey, I have a responsibility. I am a steward of this money. I want to use it wisely. Everyone that I speak with, once they start earning great money, they pay off their debt. A lot of this stuff is intuitive. They know that they want to pay off their debt. They know they want to do something different with their money than let it sit there. But that's where the paralysis comes, is from moving from knowledge to what you think you should do to actually doing it, and doing it in a way that makes you feel safe and secure. You know, how many of us have put our money into something because we thought it was a good idea and then lost it? And that happens as well.
Put their money on one bet, a hot stock, GameStop. Oh my gosh.
Or one real estate deal that went bad. You became an angel investor in a new startup and put some money in, and then threw more and more because the owners gave you, were enthusiastic, but then you didn't realize that they had no idea how to run a business, or COVID hit or something like that. So we have all these ideas and we know we should do more things. We just don't know what to do, in what order, what's going to make the most sense, who to trust. So that's where I come in and really help educate them and work with them in very specifically on their goals, and not do some kind of cookie cutter solution. Because if you look at anyone's life, no one's life resembles their neighbor or anyone next to them. There's no cookie cutter solutions here for all of it.
You know that I was, in a previous life, a headhunter, an executive recruiter. And oftentimes I'd work with people approaching the capstone of their careers, usually around the 40th birthday. That was with people who worked in traditional companies. But I imagine with entrepreneurs, it could be really any age when success hits. Success in a job or in an entrepreneurial pursuit, it takes a lot of focus. And that focus may take you away from building wealth. So how do you counsel your clients to unwind them from the celebration of that new job or that entrepreneurial pursuit to going out and buying a fancy car or a second home or spending lavishly on designer clothing versus making sound financial decisions that will grow with them as they become more successful? What are your thoughts?
Honestly, Dan, I think I'm the worst one out of all my clients. Meaning, I have to hold myself back to not go look at the new car or go do that, or because I love to spend money. And the clients that I've had the last couple of years have been so mature and so much more relaxed about it than I am. I'm like, wow, no wonder why you came into my world. You're teaching me too. But I hear what you're saying in that. Basically, what you're saying is that there are people that are spenders, right? And we want that immediate gratification. We do want to be rewarded for our efforts. It took me over 7 years to start earning any income that I was actually really proud of in my business. Long, long time, a lot of learning, a lot of pivoting. So it is important to honor that and not be sleeping on your college mattress anymore. And, to make those upgrades. And so the first thing is, it's really about the associations that are actually happening in your brain and rewiring those associations and associating pleasure with these longer term wealth building activities. And for some people, just pulling up my investment calculator and saying, okay, we're going to input your age. We're going to say that you put in $1,000 a month. This is what the growth rate is going to be. And showing them like, hey, you're 35 right now. If you just do this one thing, then you're going to have 3 million. That's enough to really excite some people. But for other people, they need to have a few things going on. Like, okay, I'm going to do a few $100 with this. I'm going to make sure I get my monthly massage. So I set it, I really put intention behind my monthly spending so that I take care of my wants and my desires and live the life that I enjoy right now, because we only have today. We could say and counsel people, do real estate and do 5 different kinds of stocks, bonds, retirement, whatnot. And at the same time, we only know for sure that this moment is real and this is what's happening. So it's striking that balance. And then also just recognizing inside of yourself, like how I said, is, hey, I'm a big spender and I have to watch myself and I know it. And now that I'm over 40, I'm more mature and I have children depending on me. And so I just, there's a lot of things in my life that yank me back, that don't allow me to just act on impulse anymore. So knowing just how you are at the root and really recognizing that, and then creating different associations in your mind with your pleasure zones, creating pleasure with being able to focus over the long haul and send that money in and invest it, and also have that holistic approach to your finances is, what am I doing now? What am I doing in my future? How am I splitting this up? Because Dan, I was talking with someone yesterday who is a financial advisor, and she was telling me that she has a friend with multi-million dollar business, and he believes that's going to be his retirement plan. But in the next breath, she said, you know, he's talking out of two sides of his mouth, because one in, like, logically, he thinks that's going to be his retirement, but he's at the same time pretty scared because we don't know the climate and, you know, how business is changing.
So you are somewhat of a financial behaviorist, I would venture to guess. And you get people who are very successful in their endeavors and careers and entrepreneurial pursuits to adopt and apply positive behaviors that will allow them to build wealth. And you mentioned that endorphin rush happens when we hit our successful milestones, you know, like the new car. So given that, how do you have a conversation with somebody who is career successful, but not financially successful in terms of building their own wealth?
Well, I'm lucky in that when someone comes to me, they're the ones just spilling the beans. And, you know, because you get to that point in a client relationship where they submit themselves to a new process, right? And, you know, you think about anyone listening to is, okay, when you finally decide that you're going to get a solution to what you're looking for, right? And you're going to make an investment of your time and your money, then you are most likely going to convince yourself that this is a person you need to listen to, and these are the things that you need to do. You're going to be, you're not going to fight and kick against it. So I have the pleasure of working with people that are open to, first of all, just telling me everything and having someone listen to them and say, you're not dumb for waiting until you're 45, 50 years old to start thinking about your retirement. It's going to be okay. This is what we're going to do. And, you know, there's that. And the other part is that even implementing a few of the teachings and the suggestions that I do, it immediately gives them relief and shifts things and gives them hope. And so what I mean by that, Dan, is let's just take cash flow planning or budgeting, which is a word, you know, the B word, something that people love to kick and scream against, especially if you're spenders like I am. But even making a few suggestions can really open up so many doors and relieve so much stress for some of my clients.
Would you offer an example?
Yeah. So for example, I had a client, she is a estate attorney, and she sent me all of her stuff. And I was looking through and I was kind of like, you know, that seems like a pretty high mortgage that you're paying. And so we emailed back and forth about it. And I sat and thought to myself, and I thought, okay, Angela, she's not paying me to be nice, and she's not paying me to blow smoke. I need to ask the hard question. And I can do this because, once again, like I said earlier, is when you decide you need a solution and you invest your time and your money into it, then you're open to being given information that may be contradictory to what you think is right for you. And it doesn't feel as abrasive as your neighbor yelling across and being like, hey, buddy, you need to get your fence on, you know what I mean? You're more open. So I finally said I asked her the hard question. I said, okay, what's going on with this mortgage? You know, is this too much house? And she come to find out there was a whole backstory. Yeah, I was engaged and we got this house and it was 5 bedrooms and it was supposed to be our families. And then the engagement didn't work. And I got the house when we broke up. And actually, now that you mentioned it, Angela, it's this huge burden and there's constant yard work. And it was just, we opened up a can of worms. Dan, in 6 weeks, she decided, and all I said to her was, would you be open to consider that there is a place that is less expensive? She had the money, okay? It wasn't like she didn't have the money. It's just she didn't have the life. She wanted to travel more with her kids, right? She has a health condition that she's managing that makes groceries and supplements and things like that a pretty good expense for her. She needed to free up some cash flow so she didn't feel so stressed about it. And within 6 weeks, she decided that she was going to sell it. She sold it on the first offer for $15,000 more than what she was asking. She got into a cute little place that she just loves, that is so much easier and requires no maintenance. Like the whole thing just completely was upside down. And she hadn't, before we started working together, even considered that the house was a burden to her and that if she could switch it around, she could free herself up, her finances, her energy, everything.
I think that the idea of home ownership is not for everybody. It's also a relic of the American dream thinking that you haven't made it until you've gotten the house that you're proud of with two cars in the garage. And I get that. You know, my grandfather came to this country in 1913 with nothing. And within 25 years' time, he built a gorgeous luxury home. That was the epitome of the American dream. Now, the home building associations are very powerful, and they perpetuate that notion of the American dream. And I think, as is the case with your estate attorney client, sometimes we get involved in things out of emotion or out of a perceived quick need without really thinking it all out. I will tell you this, I've never been happier than I am now. And why is that? For 5 years now, I have not owned real estate. I'm making more money in equities trading than I ever did in real estate. And I was terrible at real estate. We were happy if we got a little bit ahead. We never made a killing.
Yeah, real estate is a pickle. I'll tell you that. You can do great or you can go bust.
Yeah, it's not for me. Not for me. Hey, I wanted to ask you about something that you did prior to the work that you do now, and that's being involved with the Peace Corps. Now, what the Peace Corps has to do with wealth management, I'm not sure. But you must have learned something engaging with people who had very little or had nothing. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, I remember, Dan, I had some friends over, and two or three times during my service, they were like, Angela, you really should stop leaving money around. Right? Because they'd be, you know, we'd be hanging out and they'd come into my little hut and they'd see like a little bit of change or, you know, a bill here and there. You know how we do that in the US? We just have money. I have money on the kitchen table downstairs right now. They would gather it for me all the time and give it to me. You shouldn't leave your money laying around. And for me, it was just like, it was just change. It was just, you know, I took it out of my pocket. I came back from town, took it out of my pocket, set it down. And I remember having these conversations with myself about this notion of extreme poverty, because that's really what it was. You know, we didn't have running water. A lot of families still didn't have electricity. They couldn't afford to bring an electric line out there. And there's been a lot of discussions lately that I've seen on LinkedIn, and I've started some on Facebook about, does having money equal happiness? And to a certain extent, it really does, because it gets you off of the ground cooking from over a fire. There's people that got burned or were in danger, and you know, it moves you out of that poverty level into a more comfortable life. But there are so many ingredients to living and what it takes to thrive as an individual, as a family, as a community. Money is part of that picture. It's not the whole picture. But I stepped away from society for a few years to do the Peace Corps. And it was really more just reinventing myself after college and not feeling like I wanted to go into the workforce right away and wanting to take some time and explore parts of myself that I didn't know before, parts of me. And it worked. So when I did come home, I had a lot of things worked out and was ready to earn a job and do some of the regular things that, like you said, the American dream type of things. And that is, owning your own home is still alive. Every time I talk about real estate, everyone jumps in and gets all up in arms about getting loans and qualifying and this and that and the other. But, you know, in terms of my time at the Peace Corps, it really, it's all perspective, how we live and what is available to us. And I can tell you hands down that we live like the ultra rich compared to how I was living down there. And my level of happiness and fulfillment and satisfaction is dependent on so many other things other than money, because in order to live here, I have to be making a certain amount of money. I didn't have those requirements living over there.
Yes, I participated in that LinkedIn discussion, and I thought it was very interesting. I don't think money necessarily makes people happy, but what it does do is what Oprah says. It gives people choices, and choices are very powerful, and it's proportional. The more money we have, theoretically, the more choices we are able to make, and maybe that aids our happiness. And by the way, this is the money hanging around my home in a piggy bank.
You know, that was a big one, is just to see the difference in perception, because to them, that little bit of change that I had laying around was valuable. That could pay for dinner for the family, whereas for me, it wasn't valuable. I was used to much larger quantities.
So this podcast doesn't focus much on finance, but it is important to us in the broader future of work narrative. Because many of us are not going to be corporate citizens who put 40 years on the job with one company. That was our parents' and our grandparents' generations doing that. Now, you might be in a job that you are like, meh, it's okay, it's paying the bills. But then you may decide to do a side hustle, to try something else, or maybe several things. But those things take money. So my question to you is, how do we apply the wealth narrative to something that may not be about making money? I want to go out and create a local service business or service organization that does good, that provides a social noble purpose to the community. I'm not going to make a lot of money doing it, but I do need my own wealth to help build the thing. Or I might need the idea of building wealth to create a side hustle or several side hustles. And I want to add one other thing to this discussion, which is this. People who are in resource sustainability type jobs or corporate social responsibility, the idea of them having money and creating wealth just doesn't register. Because sometimes when you say wealth to somebody who is involved in things like that, they bristle. Like, I'm not a plutocrat. I don't want to make a lot of bucks. Why do we need to look at money in a positive vein if we want to do work with a noble purpose? What are your thoughts, Angela?
I know. And I get that too, Dan. Sometimes you just have a message or a limited character to make, you know, amount to make a post. And on occasion, I'll get someone that's like, I'm not interested in being a millionaire. That's not my thing. And when we look at the math, if you stop working at 75 years old, because some people say, oh, I'm going to work till the day I die. Well, my grandma is about to turn 95. She's definitely not going to work. But she has a little investment thing going on that my family draws out of to pay for her part-time in-home care assistant. So what you need to understand is that working until the day you die, there could still be 10, 20 years in between when you stop working and the day you actually die. And how is that going to look in your life? How are you going to afford your healthcare? How are you going to afford your electric bill? What is going to happen? Where are you going to live? And so we often turn the other cheek and don't really want to look at aging until we go through it with our parents, or we see our parents going through it with their parents. It starts to turn us on a little bit and us realize that unless something happens and I'm taken from this world tomorrow at a young age, this is what's ahead that I need to prepare for. So there's that part in terms of how much you actually need to just take care of your own self and not be a burden to your family. There's been studies that have asked people, you know, what are your fears about aging? I don't want to be a burden to my family. Right. That's one of the biggest fears. So there's that. And the other is, when you have done a job for a certain amount of time, or you're moving into years where you have, like you said, we have these choices. We're comfortable. We live in homes and have our cars, and we have these choices, and we want to make a greater impact. Not having any money is, you're not going to go very far. You do need to have money in order to do that one to many, that, you know, this, you are offering a service or you're trying to put something together. The money really, really helps you serve more people faster, create more impact. And so it's really just about that perception that we have about money. And it goes back to some of the things that happened to us when we were kids. Is it the root of all evil? Are you 50 years old and still actually walking around at a subconscious level believing that money is the root of all evil and that rich people are greedy? And because I bet you that the people who have that knee-jerk reaction to, oh, I don't want any money, and they shun money, it's because they have a certain relationship with it that isn't necessarily positive and uplifting. And though that's actually a huge portion of what I work with my clients, is looking at their beliefs and their perceptions about money and helping them shift them, because it really is a neutral tool, a wonderful tool that we can use to help ourselves and help the world and our communities.
Links to Angela Anderson's social media are included in the show notes for this episode at dansmolin.com. Meantime, if you haven't done so, please subscribe to this podcast wherever you get them, or listen to current and past episodes on our website at dansmolin.com. And please take a moment to positively rate and comment wherever you listen to this podcast, because that helps us to connect with new listeners. I'm Dan Smolin, and this is the Dan Smolin Podcast. Thank you for joining us on an amazing journey to the future of work, doing meaningful work. And do remember this: our best days lie ahead. Let's connect again next week.